Well, I don't... I've never known the helping of children with homework to do anything but infuriate a parent. And I warn you against it. But the problem was the word gig, G-I-G, which little Betsy insisted on pronouncing jig. And he heard this just long enough and finally took her out and with six large sticks of no value, he began to beat her to help her remember the difference between gig and jig. Well, it gets mighty cold in January in our part of the country, even when you're exercising as hard as he was. So after a while, they came in and got warm, and then they went out again because she still couldn't get it straight. And he went on. He took her out seven times. And his wife thought this was quite excessive. And she... the last time he was out beating her for nearly half an hour. And very stubbornly, the child still refused to get this thing straight. And when he came back, his wife said to him, Arnold, you've killed that child. Well, he hadn't. She didn't die for another couple of days. But when she died, he lit out. And then there's one of those marvelous scenes where you get a sense, the sense of the differences in time and distance between the early 19th century and our time. You really, when you read these testimonies, you have to adjust yourself in a way that you don't in a novel, for some reason, to a world without telephones, without cars, without railroad trains, without telegraph, without any kind of easy movement or easy communication. The community went into a fury, and they put up money. The newspaper talks of him as a tiger in human form. Well, they caught him finally, or one man caught him. He tried to commit suicide, but this time he was full of infinite remorse. They brought him back. He tried to commit suicide twice, as a matter of fact. He made no particular defense. His lawyers couldn't do much for him. There was no question about the murder. He was tried and convicted all in one day. The whole thing, the grand jury, the indictment, the trial, and the conviction were all within a matter of a very few hours. Well, he was to be hung on the 19th of July, about 2 weeks after he was tried. And they, on the day of the hanging, there were in this little town on the far frontier, in a scarcely populated part of the world, 12,000 people who came into that town. About a third of them were women, dressed in their best, many of them carrying parasols to keep the sun off. A lot of children came. And you wonder why did hangings have the marvelous drawing power that they did? Well, I think there were a lot of reasons. I think people felt that this was a kind of three-dimensional sermon. You know, the wages of sin are death, and this proves it. And there were always a good many. You saw all your neighbors, all your kinfolk, all the people for miles around. You heard some good sermons, and you heard some long prayers, and then there was this exciting climax, and everybody went. Well, you know, at noon, the militia, two companies of militia met in front of the little jailhouse, and they brought Arnold out and set him on a farm wagon, seated him on his coffin, and the sheriff rode on a horse in front, and then the ministers rode in another wagon, and then some militia, and then Arnold, and then some more militia, and the band was playing. Well, they went down Main Street two or three blocks, and they came to the bridge, and they crossed the bridge, and then they wandered down into, as I say, what is now my backyard, and the gallows was there, and a little platform they'd put up for some of the more distinguished citizens. And the clergy, three different clergymen, preached sermons. And then there were some prayers. And then Arnold stepped forward and said that he had something to say. And he said that it appeared to him that if you will not take warning at this affecting scene to avoid anger, violence of temper, you wouldn't be warned though one should rise from the dead. Then he went over and the sheriff adjusted the rope and put the hood over his head. Then the sheriff shamefacedly stepped forward and apologized to the crowd, told them that that morning he'd gotten a reprieve from the governor, but he thought that they ought to have as much of the occasion as possible. And everybody got pretty excited, and one old lady who was on the platform in a rocking chair got so excited she rocked off, and she broke her neck. So the whole thing wasn't a waste, as you might say. But they put Arnold, who had fainted dead away, and they had to revive him. They put him back on his car's wagon and drove him back to jail with the militia marching beside him and the band playing. Some of the crowd are kind of angry. They thought that they ought to, they ought to have gotten a little more for their money than that. And they thought that they couldn't make up their mind whether the sheriff had done them dirt or not. But he was running for re-election. I suppose he did the best he could. He was defeated. Well, I don't want you to think for a moment that my part of the world has a corner on this art. The South has dabbled in the art and has turned up some very fine masterpieces. My friend Frank Warner, I suppose, told you about the murder in 1866 of Laura Foster by a young veteran named Tom Dula, about whom they sang songs which, through Frank's singing, were revived and became the Tom Dooley, which all of you were hearing ad nauseum a few years ago. That's a North Carolina murder, as I remember. Then there's another famous Southern murder of Naomi Wise, which became a little orphan girl, a young orphan girl, who was murdered by Jonathan Lewis in 1808. There became another ballad named Poor Omi. And that lasted a long time. But then there is a case I had never heard of till I began doing my homework for this visit. There is an awfully nice little murder over in South Carolina in what was called the Orange Quarter, which I would assume is probably Orangeburg County, South Carolina. It is the case of the deluded Dutarte family, D-U-T-A-R-T-E. They were French, mother and father and eight children who had come over here and settled and then came to know a Moravian, kind of mad Moravian, named Christian George, who, as the Reverend Alexander Gardner, who wrote the case, filled their heads with wild notions, and he certainly did. So that you get the date, it's very early, it's 1724. And we're lucky in having any kind of record of this case. What we have is a sermon preached many years later, in the 60s, by the local Episcopal rector, the Reverend Alexander Gardner, who, as we'll see, got involved in this situation. Well, Mr. George, the mad Moravian, filled their heads then with wild notions, and he persuaded them to sort of withdraw from the community. I think they had a farm out on the outskirts. There weren't any communities, you know, these little farm units. But they withdrew from the communal life of the area. They came to believe that they were the one and only family on earth who had the true knowledge of how to worship God and the proof of this was that they frequently had visions and revelations. Then there came to them a prophet. There had been some awareness that something pretty important was going to happen, but a prophet came to them named Peter Rombert. Well, he came, and he very shortly married the eldest daughter, a young widow, and he began to make clear in a very little while that he was the new Noah, and that God had revealed to him that another flood was coming, and that this family was the chosen family. I don't know what they were going to do about the animals this time, but this was the chosen family which was to survive. Then God came to him after a little while and said that he should put aside his present wife because her dead husband would need her at the resurrection. And he was to take unto himself as wife her younger sister. Well, I think the girl's father was a little nervous about this, but Rombert said, "You don't need to worry. There will be a revelation, a sign from God. The next time we go over to the next plantation, the first thing we will see will be a hog, and this will be a sign that God has spoken to me, and that these are the things that we should do." So they went over to the next plantation, and sure enough, there was a hog coming down the road. And so they turned around and went back, and he put aside his first wife and took his second wife. And they didn't bother to sanctify this marriage. They didn't need to. Rombert sanctified it himself in his own way. And in due time, a child was born to the new wife. And this, along with some other things that were happening, bothered the legal authorities in the county. The Dutart men, and there was the father and three sons. I don't know what had happened to George, Christian George, who had started all this. He seems to have dropped out of the picture. But at any rate, these men in the family and Rombert refused to serve in the militia. God had told them not to do that. He had also told them not to work on the roads or pay any road taxes. And now had come this child, and there was a law against that unless you were married. And all in all, Justice Simmons, the local justice of the peace, decided it was time to send the constable over with three warrants. One for not paying their taxes, their road taxes, one for not serving in the militia, and the third for having children out of wedlock. Well, God told them to resist, and so they loaded up their rifles, and when the constable and his friends came with the warrants, they were met with a very sharp load of buckshot. They turned around like sensible fellows and went back home. Then the Justice Simmons and the entire company of 12 militiamen and the sheriff and the constable all set out the next day. Well, Dutart and Rombert had set up the house as a pretty good fort by this time. It was a log house, and I would assume they were doing what was usual, probably shooting through between the logs. And they fired away, as Mr. Gardner says in his pamphlet, like so many furies. Well, this time they had better luck. Justice Simmons was killed, and several of the militiamen were badly wounded. But the militia charged, and they finally captured the lot of them and took the old man, the old father, and the prophet Rombert, and the three sons to Charleston, and tried them for murder. The men persisted. Their defense was that they only did what God had told them to do personally, and that he would save them. Well, I guess God wasn't listening that day, because the three of them were hung, The two younger men, the two, 118, 120, were let go free because they seemed to be completely dominated by the others. This was not such a good idea because God spoke to one of them about a year later and told him to shoot a man without any provocation, which he did, and so that he was hanged for that. This interests me for a variety of reasons. One is because it bespeaks the contagiousness of insanity under certain conditions, kind of contagion that is still perfectly observable. I think it's a very interesting example of the operation of the state and the deluded. I think today you'd have difficulty proving that any of them were insane. You certainly wouldn't have any difficulty proving them a little odd. Another reason that interests me, another thing that interests me about this is that there is in New York State in the 1820s, the famous Matthias case. Matthias was actually he was the son of the brother of a rather respectable painter whose some of whose work I'll show you tomorrow. Matthias thought he was the reincarnation of Saint Matthew, and God spoke to him quite frequently, and he got into similar trouble. But I think this whole business of religious delusion and the way the community treats it is always worth observing. It's always worth observing how the community treats the offbeat situation, the situation that is unusual and doesn't come under its normal patterns of acceptances or taboos. Mr. Gardner was a clergyman who tried to convert these people to Episcopalianism just before they were hanged. But they continued, as he says, in their tragic delusion. Somewhere, so much for that nice early case, and so much for South Carolina. I want to move to Macon, if I may. Somewhere buried in this town, in one of its cemeteries, there is the body of Colonel Clark T. Ames, sometime owner of Ames' great New Orleans circus and menagerie. I'm sorry to disappoint you. The murder of Colonel Ames did not take place in Macon. It took place, 75, 80 miles west of here in Dawson, in Terrell County. I do hope somebody's from Dawson here. This is not an early case, it's quite a late case. But actually, it is 1870, November the 2nd, when Colonel Ames's traveling show came to Dawson and set up business. There was one big top, probably not very big, one outdoor ring which none of the testimony indicates, for which the testimony indicates no purpose. Whether they may have done some free acts out there to entice the company into the big tent, I don't know. It cost 50 cents to go into the big tent. And then there was a sideshow for 25 cents, children free, if accompanied by adults, in which there were two albino girls, one wagon full of monkeys, and one three-eyed ox. All this for a quarter. Now, actually, this is a marvelous example of the kind of distrust of the native for the foreigner, for the outsider, especially for the showman, the traveling showman. And this kind of suspicion and distrust goes back into the earliest records we have of traveling shows. You get it in the medieval accounts of jugglers. And part of the Shakespearean, the Elizabethan attitude toward actors is dependent, I think, upon this same distrust of the settled, the people who lived in a place, for those who moved around and traveled, and especially when they were showmen. It's an equally interesting reflection of the showman's distrust for the hicks, for the people in the town where they came, for whom they had no respect. Now this is a constant. It probably is at least 500 years old, and maybe thousands of years old. I don't know. But all through the circus literature, you get this problem of the animosity between those who have brought the entertainment and those who are there to be entertained. And yet with it is the absolute irresistible attraction of the circus or the traveling show. What happened is a kind of classic example of a small town brouhaha. When both sides are suspicious, both sides quick-tempered, and both sides armed. And it's also an interesting study of a small town under the stresses of excitement. About 2 o'clock on the afternoon of November 2nd, the big show had started, but the people who couldn't afford the big show were tending to go into the sideshow. A local man named William Russell and his wife Amanda and their 4 children and her brother David Oxford came up to the entrance to the sideshow. Russell asked how much, and there was some misunderstanding, and I think a perfectly honest misunderstanding on both sides. It was a question of how many children, perhaps how old the children were, how much Russell owed. His wife and her brother, David Oxford, and the children started to go in. Russell paid some money, started to go in too, but then the ticket seller thought that some of them were trying to get in free, followed them in, laid his hand on Mrs. Russell's shoulder. Mr. Russell got angry. There was a kind of tussle, and then they seemed to settle it. But there were behind them 2 fellows named John and Charlie Kelly. And Mrs. Russell testified at the trial, said if Mr. Russell had been drinking, I couldn't tell it on him. Which is a nice way of putting it. And one gets the feeling that she was experienced in telling it on him. But he seems to have been sober enough, but the Kelly boys were not sober. And the Kelly boys were armed. And the Kelly boys felt that local womanhood had been insulted, that the honor of the town was at stake, and that anyway it would be great fun to start a fight. So they began shooting up in the air at first. But with the first shot, Colonel Ames, who owned the circus, came from over at another place where he was in another ticket wagon, seems to have gotten the gun out of his draw and come on over. And I don't think he ever fired a shot, but the Kelly boys started shooting at him, and he ducked under the tent of the sideshow. And they began shooting through the tent. They got David Oxford first, the brother of Mrs. Russell. And then they got Mr. Ames, who, because he was squatting down to get under the tent, got one bullet did an awful lot of damage, sort of a jackpot shot. In the confusion, it's very interesting to watch the testimony at this place, because the testimony is quite confused, and people testified, as they wanted to remember it, I think, rather than as it necessarily actually happened. And we never have any testimony from any of the people employed by the circus. The circus got out of town and nobody would ever come back. Ames, who was very seriously wounded, was taken to the house of one of the local people. called for a minister and called for a lawyer. And he drew up a will which left his wife $50,000 and left his brother and father $100,000 and the circus. I think this is extremely interesting because I haven't checked it. I have a little chart that I was going to check with that will translate the value of a dollar at a particular time in the 19th century it never is down into our own time. It's always about 1950, and then you have to add a little beyond that. But $50,000 in 1870 was worth, $150,000 was worth a whale of a lot of money. And it leads one to think that the traveling circuses probably were more often very solvent than we have realized. He died. Oh, I forgot to say one of the other victims of the Kelly shooting was the mother of the albino twins, who caused a good deal of excitement because she had a marvelous screaming voice, and it added a good deal to the confusion. Well, one wounded and two dead, and then so they arrested the Kellys, and first they tried them for the murder of Ames. Well, these were all local people on the jury, of course, and nobody from the circus came to testify, and so Mr. Ames was unavenged by the state, and John Kelly and Charles Kelly were acquitted. Then they tried John Kelly for the murder of David Oxford. Well, this is a different matter. Oxford was a local man. So John Kelly was convicted of voluntary manslaughter. I'd never heard of that charge before. I suppose these things differ from state to state, but it's a rather nice term. He did the shooting all right, but he didn't intend to kill Oxford. So that's voluntary manslaughter. Well, they put a guard around the jail the night after the conviction, but they took the guard away at 9 o'clock next morning when everybody in town was up and around, and that's when John Kelly and his brother Charles escaped, and to the best of my knowledge, were not heard from again. Now, this is a case whose interests lie, for me at least, in the relationship between the traveling show and the community. This sort of, I don't mean that murder, but difficulties are often arising, and you get accounts of this, but never before have I seen the testimony of the account, the testimony that gives you an idea of how people felt about this, the attitude toward the circus, the attitude toward circus people, the suspicion of the circus people toward the local people. This becomes a kind of segment of the social history of the circus, and the circus is a phenomenon all over America in the 19th century, a wonderfully interesting one. This could have happened almost anywhere, though I think it probably more likely that men went armed in villages in the 1870s in the South than in the North. The average farm community in the North would not have had a couple of men who were armed, I think. In the West, certainly. But in the Northeast, probably not. I want to conclude this evening with a case that I offer you with a certain amount of hesitation because I have only one source of information and I have not been able to see the testimony. It's when you get sworn testimony that you really are getting your teeth into the facts. What I have is a pamphlet written probably about very shortly after the trial, published in Philadelphia by a firm that frequently published crime cases, but usually quite a long time after the event. I'm going to read you the title page, which has the whole gist of it in one wonderfully sort of snug statement. The sad case of Mrs. Kate Southern, beautiful, virtuous Georgia wife, who, don't you love titles like this? Who, being maddened to insanity by the outrageous taunts of a bad woman who had enticed her husband away, killed her. After terrible and yet romantic adventures, during her flight, she was arrested, tried, convicted, and sentenced to be hung, in large letters. Notwithstanding that, besides having a little child, she was about to become a mother again. The sentence has been commuted by Governor Colquitt, but the public excitement is so high that the legislature is to be appealed to set her free. The most thrillingly touching book ever published. Well, it is just about. The scene is Pickens County, Georgia. And I, curiously enough, I cannot give you the sure dates. I think that maybe the Philadelphia company that published this book kept publishing it for some time and very carefully put in bad leads every time they had the last two numerals of the dates. You can go through the, I haven't seen the original, I've been working from a Xerox, but every date in the account of the case has the last number in the 1870, whatever it was, with a bad piece of lead, bad type. And I think there was I don't think this is an accident. This is a triangle. The man is a young man named Bob Southern, in his early 20s, not a well-to-do farmer's son, but the son of a comfortable, successful farmer. Good-looking fellow, a little harum-scarum, but a man who was basically to prove to have a good deal of character, it seems to me. The other woman is Mrs. Narcissa Fowler Canart, whom I shall, for briefness, call, as they did in her own time, I shall call her Sis. But any time I mention her, she's the other woman, and watch out for her. She had been briefly married. She was a wrecker of other people's marriages. Hers had ended in divorce. She was a constant flirt. On the other hand, she came from a quite well-to-do family. Probably a stratum in the rural community, a stratum above Bob Southern's family, and a stratum above Kate Hambrick Southern's family. Narcissa Fowler Canart, she was a Hester always happy to win one more A. Kate Hambrick Southern, the good woman in this case, was a bright brunette with auburn hair, splendid eyes, I'm quoting now, and again, a voluptuous figure, but she was subject to epileptic fits, which is an important factor in the case. One would guess from the evidence that hers was a conservative, comfortable farm family, perhaps the equivalent, the equals of Bob Southern's, perhaps a little less well-to-do. I think it's interesting that she had never learned to dance, though it was a community in which there was a good deal of square dancing. But she was indeed the very essence of innocence. Bob Southern met her, probably had known her all his life, but this is the sort of thing I can't answer. He married her on Sunday, December 10th. And by using that marvelous perpetual calendar in the World Almanac, I deduced that it must have been the year 1876, because it's either 76 or 71, because those were the only 2 years in that decade in which the 10th of December came on Sunday. The two girls had been rivals for his attentions for a long time, and the innocent, unworldly one had won out. But the rivalry didn't stop at the wedding. 2 days after the wedding, he was invited to a party at Sissa's house, quite a big party. She had made it clear that his wife was not, his bride was not welcome, and he went without her. And as a matter of fact, they saw a good deal of each other that night, and they kept on seeing each other. Word kept getting back to the bride that her husband and Sis were seen walking in the woods. Of course, it's possible they were interested in botany. But at any rate, the word kept getting back to Kate Southern, and there were tears and there were scenes, and he would promise not to do it again, and then about a week later he would do it again. His favorite rejoinder was that he wasn't going to be a slave to his wife. The joker was, of course, that he had become a kind of slave of Sis Canard's. There is evidence, plenty of evidence, as the story goes on, that he did love his wife, but it's really an example of kind of witchcraft, I think. Sis had put a sort of spell on him that he couldn't break. Well, things went along this way, up and down, back and forth, and finally there was quite a bad scene in which it was evident that the marriage was in serious danger. And so he gave up Sis Canard and settled down with his wife, and things seemed to have gone smoothly for quite a period of time, but how long, I don't know. Whether this is a matter of weeks or months, it's the kind of thing, again, that you'd know from the trial testimony, but you don't know from a recap. I think one observing the marriage at this point would have said that it had weathered the storm. And then they went over to her families after a certain length of time, and I would guess this was a distance maybe of 5 or 6 miles. And there was a party. All the young people in the community came over, and some of the boys brought their fiddles, and some of the girls persuaded Sis to come along and make up, not with Bob, but with Kate Southern, and to forget the whole thing. Well, they underestimated Sissy. She came with a chip on her shoulder, and no sooner got in than she cornered Bob, and made it very obvious to everybody that she had him for the moment. Then she got him to dance a set with her. This was the first time that there had ever been dancing in the Hambricks' house, in Kate Southern's father's house. And they had asked permission of Mr. Hambrick to dance, and he had said yes. Here, I think you've got a reflection of different, perhaps of different religious patterns, but certainly differences in attitude toward the gaieties of the world. And I think this perhaps explains many things. Bob sat with his wife after he had danced, and after she'd grown very angry, sat with her and tried to persuade her to get out and dance a set with him. And she refused, whether it was because she was too angry, whether she didn't approve of dancing, or whether she quite possibly and quite sensibly, never having danced, didn't want to be shown up in comparison with Sissy, who was a very accomplished dancer. I don't know. But at any rate, they sat there. You can feel the atmosphere of an angry young wife, this flirtatious girl out on the dance floor, and the poor man sitting there trying to make some sort of sense out of it. I'm sure none of the men in the room have been in exactly that position, but they'll all know how he felt, poor fellow. My heart goes out to him for a moment or two. After a little while, he went off in the back room with some of the boys, and she went into her father's room, a room where he had kept his books and things, and borrowed his penknife for a marvelous reason. And I think this is a bona fide reason. She went to get his penknife to make toothpicks for the guests. I don't think she did it at that point with murder in her heart. I think this was just one of the obligations of hospitality. But I'd never heard of that before. I thought it was a nice point. Well, she came back in the room, penknife in hand, all set to fulfill her obligations as a hostess. And she looked up, and her husband and Sis were dancing. And she forgot all about the toothpicks. She rushed out onto the floor, pushed her husband aside, and began stabbing Sis Canard very rapidly, very violently, and I must say, very successfully. They were soon rolling around on the floor, and in a very few minutes, she said afterward that everything went blank. You know, it's been used so many times, it is impossible to believe that people really said it. I think she may have had an epileptic fit at this point, and it's possible that everything did go blank. But at any rate, that's what she said later. Well, when they pulled her off, Sis Canard was only going to move to a funeral dirge from then on. She was through dancing. Bob Southern, this was the moment of decision for him. I think that quite as he made clear from then on, felt that essentially he was responsible for what had happened. And in the confusion, somebody shut the doors, and somebody yelled, "Who did this?" And Kate said, "I did. And I'd do it again 1,000 times over. She robbed me of my husband." Somebody else yelled, "Killer," and somebody yelled, "Hanger." And Bob suddenly rose up in the midst of this confusion. He put his arm around his wife. He drew a gun out of his pocket. And he said, "Gentlemen, I am going through that door, and I'm taking my wife with me if I have to shoot my way through." And they went through. And now you come to this business that I was talking about this morning of the Southern sense of family. He went with his wife, who had just committed murder, to his father and brothers, told them what had happened. There was no question in their minds what to do. The family closed forces. They took their guns and ammunition and the money they had, and the four men and the girl started that night in a wagon to get out of that county. As a matter of fact, they went as far as near Murphy, North Carolina. And they stayed there some time. Her child was born there, and I would guess from the rather scanty evidence they may have been there the better part of a year. And then started back. Whether they started for Texas or whether they started back to her own county or not, I don't know. The evidence is confusing on this point. But there was a fellow named Findlay, a kind of self-appointed detective who had made it his business to try to find her. There was a $500 reward for her, and he went out to find her and found them on the way back, and through a kind of fluke caught up with them and got a local posse to come with him, and they captured them without any shooting at all. Well, then the trial came. And I find this a very interesting case, because here is a woman. Well, let me start by saying that anywhere in the United States, and certainly in this part of the world. In the 1870s, a man who found another man attempting to take his wife away with him and shot that man would have been within the unwritten law, and no jury would have convicted him. Here's a woman who was faced with exactly the same circumstances. A woman was trying to take her husband away from her, ruin her marriage, and she shot her. And yet, when she was tried by a jury of her peers, she was convicted and sentenced to be hung, despite the fact that she was pregnant at the time. Women are almost never hung in that condition. This goes back into English penal tradition, certainly to the 17th century, and I don't know how much earlier. Well, there was a great lot of noise. The people rose up in violent disagreement with the jury. The governor commuted her sentence to 10 years. And then there is interesting business about which prison camp she should go to. She was sent to the easiest prison camp in Washington County. Now, one of the things that is interesting about this case is that her husband had gone to jail with her and stayed with her throughout the trial and went to the prison camp with her on a voluntary basis. He was never tried. He was never convicted. He was never in jeopardy at all himself, but he went into voluntary imprisonment with her. There's one nice little touch. The family, her family and his family, both had lost everything they had in the defense of her and in the year that they were away, so that they didn't have any money and they had debts. The constable who was taking her to the prison camp got to Atlanta, and there was a tremendous crowd who had come down to the cars, as they said, the railroad station, to see her. Well, he hustled her into a little room in the railroad station and worked out a very nice, thoughtful device. He charged anybody who wanted to see the famous murderess $1, and he could come in, walk in the room, see her, and walk out. And he made better than $100, which he paid over to her husband to help defray some of their expenses and pay some of their debts. Well, a little irregular, but quite interesting and quite thoughtful, you know, in a way. I'm sorry to tell you that she went to the prison camp, and there is a postscript on the pamphlet, which I have, which says that as they go to press, she was dying. And I haven't any idea whether she died or what happened, but I hope that someone of Miss Strong's students in American Studies will find the newspapers of the 1870s and clear up all of the mysteries that are hanging around about this case. As a matter of fact, there may be more than newspaper accounts. There may be testimonies of this case, because obviously it was a very popular one. There may be much better sources than the only one I could find, that having been listed in Tom McDade's bibliography. There are all sorts of mysteries here. The fact that the part of the country where these families lived was a part, like just as there were pockets of Southern sympathizers in New York State during the Civil War, war between the states. When in Rome. There were pockets of Southern sympathizers in New York State. So, as you recall, there were pockets of Northern sympathizers in New York. And this area in Georgia, and the area in which this case took place, was such a community. And who was on which side, I don't know. But I think this may have been a factor, one way or another. The prison scenes, the kind of prison camp to which she was sent, is full of interest in terms of the history of penology. That whole business about the dancing and the fact that most families did and some families didn't in the same community. The clan loyalties, the moralities involved, the whole question of sissy's morality in a small community is worth examining. And then those lovely toothpicks. What I'm saying here is, well, and then, of course, the great problem of the right of a woman to defend her marriage as a man would have a right to defend his marriage. Do we have a kind of double standard in reverse? Wasn't a woman given this right in the rural community at this point? Or were there other factors that offset it? I don't know, but what I'm really saying here is, what I said this morning, that it's out of little segments like this that we gradually build. These are little tiles in a mosaic, if you will, out of which we gradually build a truer concept of the past than we can do from the often broad generalizations of the enthusiastic historian. Thank you very much. Convinced she did it. The people that write the plays and the dances usually think she did. There's a great choreographic treatment of that case, you know. Yeah, marvelous. And there's a recent book on this case within the last 2 years. It's a good book, but I don't think he has a solution either. It is not as good a case as the Halls Mills case from the 20s, which is more complex yet, because there were two murders, but that one hasn't been solved either. I think probably, as a connoisseur, I think I find the Hall Mills case the most interesting of all. But I like the early ones. I like this, as I say, the peeling back of life that you get from the material. No, I don't think many people have. No. But you know, Crime is interesting because it's against society, and society reacts to it. And so you get not only the criminal, but then you get society itself in its reaction. And this I find very interesting.